Support for WGTD's morning show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. jackandrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program online at carthage.edu/aspire. The morning show is next.
And we welcome you to the morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really happy that we can begin today's program with Helen Sampson, who is Quality Coordinator for Kenosha County's Aging and Disability Resource Center. And we're having this interview today at the suggestion of Troy McDonald. Troy told me about a brand new program that the ADRC has put together during this time of COVID-19. And so we're going to get to that in just a moment, a wonderful new service that is going to make a real difference, and I'm sure already has, in the lives of some of the senior citizens in Kenosha County. But we're going to also talk in general about the kind of things which they offer under more normal circumstances. And of course, what we have right now are not normal circumstances whatsoever. So anyway, I'm glad we can have these next few minutes with Helen Sampson. And we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Great. So first of all, under more normal circumstances, what is Kenosha County's Aging and Disability Resource Center all about? What kinds of things do you primarily offer?
Sure. The Aging and Disability Resource Center, otherwise known as the ADRC, is that one-stop shop for older persons, adults with intellectual or physical disabilities, and the people who care about them. It is that place for first and foremost information. When you are coping with new issues and problems in your life, you need good information. And the ADRC is that objective, reliable source of good information. So you can call here Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., and you're going to get connected with an information specialist who understands the landscape of services and concerns that older adults and persons with disabilities are coping with. And that person is going to help you kind of peel the onion and get you connected.
Wonderful. What is your responsibility as quality coordinator? What does that position mean?
Well, this is what I tell people. What can you not fit under quality? So I really, my role is to be flexible and to move with where the need is at any given moment. Certainly, quality has always been a critical part of our values at the ADRC. We want to make sure we are giving the best possible services within the scope of available resources. So I certainly help with training opportunities and looking at processes that could be more customer friendly. But again, it's really showing up to wherever the need presents.
Very good. So I'm asking you a question that I've asked quite a number of different guests over the last couple of months now, and namely, what are your recollections of when it first became increasingly clear that COVID-19 was going to be impacting, for instance, Kenosha and Kenosha County, and would likely impact very directly the kind of services that the ADRC offers? What do you remember about those first conversations as this threat began to really loom in a serious way?
Well, Greg, the folks that this virus is affecting the most or disproportionately are our folks. So those conversations happened fast and furiously, and we went into action right away. And I am so proud of this organization. There is very little that we aren't still doing that we were doing before. We're doing everything differently, but we're still doing it. Our phone lines are still open. Our support for caregivers is still available. We're doing adult protective services investigations. Really, we're screening people for the long-term care programs and making sure that those access to public benefits is still really seamless for folks. So it's just about how we're doing it. You know, we're like everybody else. We're using Zoom when we can, and we are on the phone with folks talking through all the issues and getting them connected.
You know, as I speak to you, it makes me realize that this has been a very disconcerting and from time to time overwhelming situation for most of us.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I've really stopped to think about, for instance, our seniors, even beyond the really, of course, crucial matter of their exceptional vulnerability to COVID-19. But beyond that, just the fact that they find themselves confronted with all of this wrenching change,
right,
and a shift over into different means of delivery that probably for some of them is a bit scarier than for others who maybe have had that as more a regular part of their lives. What can you say about the seniors that you have been working with, and what kind of special challenges have there been in terms of keeping them calm and keeping them, in a sense, on the same page with you through all of this?
Right. Well, you know, we are very lucky that we are next door to the public health department here at the Job Center. So we have really followed their guidance. And what has been important is that, you know, sort of that two-handed approach, that while we are very clear about the information and the cautions, we are also trying to be hopeful with people. So that, I think, has been one of the big pieces that our folks on the phone are doing. Certainly initially, they were really working to calm people down and to reassure, and also to make sure that they have good information. And, you know, that's been an ongoing struggle. Information has still been very conflicted and very chaotic. So to be able to just hold that line with our callers and our clients to say, if you are an older adult, if you have a comorbid condition like diabetes or a heart condition, you are vulnerable. And so we're going to help you stay safe in whatever way we can. So, you know, one of the things that changed immediately was the delivery of home-delivered food meals, that we went from the hot meal everyday delivery to a weekly frozen meal. That limited exposure, and it got people the meals they needed. So that's the kind of thing, is we're just keeping in mind, what is it that we need to do to protect our folks?
I was just thinking that you are talking about your clients, but you're probably also talking about your volunteers when it comes to keeping people safe. And I am certain that you have more than a few of your volunteers who are part of that same vulnerable population.
Right. So the Kenosha Area Family and Aging Services, CAFASI, has the contract for the home-delivered meals in the congregate sites. And absolutely, that was one of the first things that we got very clear about, is that the bulk of their volunteers are the vulnerable population. So we went very quickly to staff at the ADRC, at CAFASI, and at the Kenosha Achievement Center delivering the meals. It's really about staying detached to how you do what you do and attached to the reason you're doing what you do.
Absolutely. What difference does it make for certain clients that you have that are not in the city of Kenosha, but in more, in a sense, kind of far-flung areas? Is that at all in a sense, kind of a complication in terms of them having access to all that they need?
Well, I mean, pre-COVID, it's always been a little more challenging to find caregivers who can go out into the county. We're in the middle of a caregiver crisis as it is. There are not enough caregivers, right? So finding those folks who are willing to travel has been a challenge. And, you know, I certainly have heard concerns about not enough services in the county, but we really are thoughtful about that. So all of the meals are getting delivered throughout the county. There's two pickup spots for meals as well, if you can pick them up yourself, and one is in the county and one's in Kenosha. There are services, you know, we really try to stay conscious about where we're holding our services, some of it in the county, some of it here. But yeah, I think there's a little bit more isolation and a little less resources, which is more to do with geography than anything.
Of course. I'm always reminded of something that I experienced way, way, way back in the late 1980s. The first time I went to the Kenosha County Fairgrounds to man a booth that the Kenosha Symphony had. And I didn't know my geography at all. I had no idea how far west I was going to travel. I couldn't believe I was still in Kenosha County after driving and driving and driving. So that's my memory of this county, is that it's a long county, and there is so much west of I-94, and those who live in Kenosha or Racine sometimes forget that.
Yes. I had a very similar experience. One of the first meals routes I did after the virus hit was out in the county, and I was like, where did all these lakes come from? I had no idea there were all these lakes out here.
We're speaking with Helen Sampson, and she is quality coordinator for Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. And as she has been recounting, they are continuing to offer their array of services to their clients despite the onset of COVID-19, of course. Is a very, very significant complication in all of this. So Helen Sampson, one of the things that ADRC has done is not only sort of maintained course and, you know, tried to sustain all of your normal operations, but even in the middle of all this, you've added at least one significant service that, if I understand correctly, has not been a part of your services before this. Explain to our listeners what you are now taking on.
Correct. Well, you know, this is how we do business, is we listen to the people who call us. So in the first few weeks, and I have to go back, I think it was March 18th that the building closed to people walking in. And we stopped really meeting face to face with people except when absolutely necessary. So those first few weeks after that, we started getting phone calls from people. How do I do grocery shopping now? I know I'm not supposed to go to the grocery store, but I don't have a computer that I can go online and order with. And there were enough of those that we started thinking, okay, this feels like that, you know, hole that nobody's able to really show up for. If you have a computer and you're tech savvy, you're going online with whatever grocery store you want and you're doing their online ordering and you're doing the delivery service, great. Or maybe you have family members who are doing that for you. Absolutely fine. Great. We don't want to replace anybody's systems. But there was this pocket of people that really were struggling. So I don't know if you ever remember the Stone Soup story, but it was one of those moments where everybody put a little bit into the soup, and pretty soon we had a delicious service to offer. So CAFASI has a few volunteers that are able to do an immediate, quick, small shopping. So if somebody calls us and that's what their need is, we hook them up with CAFASI. For those people who need some regular grocery shopping, don't have access to a computer, Then we will take them on as a grocery shopping client, where our staff will go on the website, develop their cart with them, and then KAC, the Kenosha Achievement Center, will get notification of that. They will actually pay upfront for that with their account, and then the customer pays them back, and Caravan delivers the groceries.
Wow.
Right? There were a few glitches along the way, I'm not going to lie. But it's working. We've had 21 referrals. We have 16 open cases right now, and we have everyone from adult protective services workers to information and assistance to outreach to our mobility manager doing grocery shopping and our clerical staff.
Wow.
Yeah.
You are touching on something that I think a lot of us aren't sufficiently mindful of, and that is the fact that so much of the world is set up online, even before COVID-19, and now even more so.
Right.
And so, so many of the things that we just blithely do online without giving it a thought, we don't stop to realize that that is beyond the reach of somebody who doesn't have a computer or doesn't have Wi-Fi or doesn't know anything about how any of this works. And
right.
It is so crucial that that those people are not forgotten.
So we are working with two grocery stores. We chose Walmart because they accept the food share card. And then we chose Festival on 80th because they had a good delivery system. And we just wanted to, you know, keep it kind of contained and give people a little bit of choice. And so I was talking to a woman at the Festival corporate office, and they pulled her off of her regular job, and she has been helping the seniors who do have access to computers but don't have the confidence or the, you know, really the experience to do the online shopping. And I was so impressed. She told me, like, the first couple of weeks she had about 50 callers she was working with. And then about a month later, she was down to 10. So these seniors were able to learn and get confident and now are on their way. So I really think that for all of us is gonna be the next frontier, is how do we make technology available and help people to work through the fears and new learning.
Right. I think it's partly because we just, again, make so many assumptions that this is a language that everybody speaks, that everybody is, in a sense, conversant in. And the longer we go and the more we make that assumption, the less the less helpful a lot of these technologies are. I mean, it becomes more and more streamlined, in a sense, more and more simplified, but that makes it more and more difficult for a newcomer to navigate.
Right. Yeah, I'm brewing on that one, because I think that's where we got to go next.
Right.
I will tell you, the other thing is that we have, Kenosha is very fortunate to have a dementia care specialist on our staff, which is not every ADRC is funded for that. And her name is Susan Johnson, and she works one-on-one with people who have dementia and their caregivers. And this is another population that is really isolated right now, and not able to get the respite that they were able to get before. So we are doing some Zoom calls with those caregivers to give them an opportunity to connect with each other and talk about what those challenges are. So there's another one coming up May 28th, next Thursday. So people can call our office and register, and we'll give you the link to hop on those calls as well. But the side benefit to the grocery shopping, just like this caregiver Zoom call, is, you know, people are waking up to how isolated so many of our older adults are. And I mean, those of us who have been doing this work for 30 years are kind of smiling going, yeah, we knew that.
We were trying to tell you. Yeah.
Welcome to the party, you know. Yeah. And just having someone do grocery shopping over the phone with you is a start of a relationship. You know, there's conversation that's happening there. There's, you know, food is a kind of an intimate thing. So when you're talking about which brand you want and why you like this brand and not the other brand, it's, you know, there's a relationship happening.
Yeah, we all need that. Absolutely. With your clients, is it hard to make all of them understand the need for the physical distancing, the touchless transactions that I'm sure are sometimes part at least of some of these services? And that has to be painful, I should think, on your end, because that's one of the nicest things about much of what you offer. And that's one aspect of it that I'm sure is either curtailed altogether or greatly limited.
Yeah, I'm an old hospice social worker, so this not hugging thing is causing havoc with my spiritual well-being. And yes, it is very difficult, especially for those folks that have some kind of cognitive impairment, you know, with our folks who have a dementia. And we learn and teach and share strategies around distraction and refocusing and those kinds of things that help. But those are true in the day-to-day lives of caregivers. You know, these are very challenging situations for caregivers, period. COVID has not helped, but they've already had to learn a lot of coping strategies.
Right.
The people who didn't have those coping strategies that I think are even more stressed out.
Right. Well, and I really appreciate the point that you made that COVID-19 has revealed a lot to us about, in a sense, our collective selves and certain realities that, in a sense, were right there in plain sight that we have failed to see. And then also some realities that, by their very nature, have not been in plain view. And we are starting to understand those kind of realities as well. And one hopes we will do something about that as we emerge from all this.
Well, you can't not know what you know. So once we've learned it, I hope we don't let it go. And at this point, it's really about thinking about our community and our society as a whole, and knowing that the behaviors that we choose are going to protect the frailest among us.
Right.
And that is our value.
If people want more information about Aging and Disability Resource Center, if they want more information about what you offer, and if anyone listening is thinking that they could potentially be a volunteer and part of some of the services you offer, what is the best thing for them to do?
The best thing is to call our direct main line, which is 262-605-6646. We also have a lot of information on our website, which is adrc.kenoshacounty.org. And no www in front, just adrc.
And people will find you. Helen Sampson, Quality Coordinator for Kenosha County's Aging and Disability Resource Center. I'm really grateful to you for making time in what I'm sure is an intense schedule to join me on the morning show and to tell the good story of the Aging and Disability Resource Center. And best wishes to you and all of your hardworking staff and volunteers in this challenging time.
Thank you so much, Greg, and thank you for sharing the information that people need to know.
You're listening to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program will be coming up in just a moment. A quick reminder that today's forecast calls for mostly sunny skies, nice warm conditions. There is, however, the 40% chance of a scattered rain shower. We're headed for a high today of 83 degrees with
Slightly cooler readings expected near the lake. Part two is coming up in just a moment. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and we're going to finish out today's program with a 2010 interview with one of my favorite authors, Mary Roach, who specializes in writing works of nonfiction that explore really intriguing subjects and topics. And this particular book, called Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void, explores all kinds of endlessly fascinating questions that do not come up in the standard books about space travel and what it means for human beings to survive in outer space. This book is published by W.W. Norton & Company. Again, the author, Mary Roach. So, did anything in particular prompt your examination of this topic?
Yes, I found out about this rather bizarre place called the Bedrest Facility. It's in Galveston, Texas, and it's a place where NASA simulates the effects of zero gravity, weightlessness. And they do this by having people lie in bed 24 hours a day for 3 months. They basically put on your PJs and don't take them off for 3 months and don't get up, don't even sit up, not once, for anything. And this is that they're trying to mimic not having any weight on your bones and not using your muscles and studying how the body begins to basically dismantle itself. You know, on a Mars mission, you're talking about you could lose up to half of your bone mass because your body's going, you know, we don't seem to be using this anymore.
Maybe you don't need it. Maybe you
don't need it. We can use the resources on something else. So anyway, I just the notion that there's these people being, you know, on the NASA payroll to lie in bed and watch TV and play video games kind of intrigued me. And then I started finding out about other elaborate simulations here on Earth, and I realized you could almost go into space without ever leaving Earth.
And it's really incredible. I mean, all that we never stop to think about that is involved, and of course this whole matter of what does it take to live and thrive in the environment of space. One of the things that struck me again and again is how remarkably people manage to sort of put themselves inside this unprecedented question. I mean, for all the mishaps and mistakes that got made in the early days of the space program, I am impressed with how much they were thinking about some of these matters more than I expected.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in the early day, you know, it's right after World War One when, you know, rockets first, you know, they started out, they were a way of delivering bombs quickly. No one was thinking about rockets as a way to send man into space. And then these scientists were like, well, hey, we could use these things to put a person up into space. And then they began thinking, well, what will happen without gravity? And they were these elaborate scenarios. They thought that their blood would just churn in place, that it wouldn't circulate. They thought the organs would change shape, stop functioning, that the vestibular system would go completely nutty and that people would not even be able to see because their heads would be spinning so fast. A lot of hand-wringing went on back then, but they were really determined to try it. So there was this era of sending, you know, launching these enormous V-2 and Aerobee rockets with one little tiny rhesus monkey way up at the top, and he's all wired up, and they're like, he's okay, I think he's okay. So it was, and then moving on to the chimpanzee era, where, you know, Alan Shepard and John Glenn both had been sort of beaten into space by chimps because the space agency just wasn't comfortable sending up a human being and without doing one dress rehearsal with one of the little hairy guys. So it was quite a protracted era of absolute anxiety about what will the lack of gravity, because gravity, you know, it's one of the fundamental forces of the universe. You don't mess with that. People just didn't know.
Well, and getting back to the whole matter of, for instance, loss of bone mass when we are seated and still for such a long period of time, as, for instance, a human being would be on a long journey to the planet Mars. One of the things you suggest is that the studies indicate that right now, if we were to send a man or woman to Mars, it's very likely that if and when they stepped out of the capsule, their legs would break. I mean, from the impact of a simple step onto the surface of the planet. I mean, and one just shudders to think about what that would feel like. I mean, not only for the astronaut, but I mean, what that would feel like for the space industry, for a moment that should be one of triumph, to be completely undone by a mishap like that, unanticipated.
Yeah, right. When the whole world is watching, you know, you step down and there's this ominous crack. Probably, it would probably be more dangerous when they come back to Earth, where you have Earth gravity. Mars, you have a third of the gravity, so you do have a reduced load. So they might be okay on the surface of Mars, but certainly when they came back, they'd have to really watch their step. And the countermeasures that we give them, exercise. I mean, the astronauts do like 2 hours of exercise to try to combat this degradation that happens. And what I heard it would be about from a third to 50% loss of bone mass on a Mars mission, which is that's the equivalent of going into a wheelchair.
Hmm. Among the many fascinating tests that you tell us about in your book, I mean, tests to ascertain the suitability of a given candidate to go up into space. One of the first we learn about is something called the Thousand Cranes Test. Tell us who administered this and why.
Sure, that was in Japan, the Japanese Space Agency, Space Exploration Agency. They were choosing new astronauts for the astronaut corps, and I came and watched for a day. They had the 10 finalists in an isolation chamber, and the test that they gave them, I didn't know what they were going to do. There were these sheets of paper, colored paper, that each astronaut candidate had, and they had to fold origami cranes. Each one did 100 cranes, and they had to string them along on string. And then these strings were given to the psychologists to examine, and they were looking, sort of comparing the early cranes versus the last cranes. Did the folds get sloppy? Was the person able to focus on this repetitive task? And at first I was thinking, what does this have to do with space? But you have to bear in mind, space has changed a lot from the days of the Mercury 7 and the Wright stuff. It's now, there's a lot of tedium and a lot of repetitive chores, and you want somebody whose accuracy isn't going to diminish under pressure. Like, you've got a time pressure, which is similar to a spacewalk. You've got to get your task done before the time runs out, before your oxygen runs out. The task may be very repetitive. So in a way, it was a brilliant little test. Not something you can really picture John Glenn or Alan Shepard doing, but it was the way that they'd come up with to look at these people's various traits and talents.
You underwent I think a series of different tests, but one of them involved the encroachment of forces on kind of our mental facility. I think that might have been something involving air or gravity being gradually decreased and questions being posed. Tell our listeners about that and what sort of happened. I mean, and what was interesting, as you describe it, is how you thought you were fine or felt fine, and yet when you look at the tangible evidence of the answers you gave to some of these very simple questions, it was clear that you weren't.
Yeah, they as part of my orientation to go on that weightless flight simulator, they put you in a vacuum chamber, which this is a chamber where you can pump out the air and create a box of outer space. In other words, no air at all. But what they did, they took us gradually up to about 25,000, the equivalent of 25,000 feet, in this chamber, and then they had us take off our oxygen mask to see the effects of low oxygen on the brain. And it was amazing, because you had this, you felt fine, you didn't really feel strange, it was a little weird, you knew that something might be happening, but they had a questionnaire, and they had one of the questions was, what does NASA stand for? And obviously, I've been researching this book for over a year at that point. I know what NASA stands for. And I look back at my answer sheet when I got out, and I had just written N. I gave up after N, and I moved on to the next one. Another one was subtract 20 years from the date of your birth. That one just completely stumped me. 20 years, like 1959, 49, 39. How hard is that? Couldn't do it. Hmm. Left it blank, moved on. So just imagining what it's like. You know, if you were in space and you had a leak in your spacesuit, you'd be exposing yourself to that vacuum, and you very quickly would be in a lot of trouble.
Right. And, of course, at a moment when you would need every bit of your brains and experience to bring to bear on whatever the problem was, it would desert you. And
right.
That's so frightening to think about.
Oh, yeah.
One of the most basic things you learned in the course of your research, I mean, almost right off the bat, is that there's essentially two different kinds of astronauts. And until that moment, that had never really dawned on you. And I think for most of the rest of us, that doesn't dawn on us as well. Tell mm-hmm. us about that distinction. It really is important in understanding a lot of what you write about.
Sure. Well, I think if I'm like most of us, my association with astronauts was forged during the Apollo era. And then the Mercury era, where you think of them as these heroic, macho, fighter pilot, aggressive, virile types of people who were able to, you know, take great risks and plunge into the unknown and go where nobody had gone before, and it was all very dramatic. And now we're in this era, we have been in this era for, you know, a decade or more of just of orbiting larger spacecraft, long-term missions, you know, 6 months to a year, and now that right stuff is absolutely the wrong stuff. You don't want to be working with somebody who's like very vain, very big ego, very fearless, very forceful personality. You want people who play well with others. So now the list of NASA astronaut attributes, recommended attributes that I came across includes things like ability to form stable and quality interpersonal relationships, fairness, flexibility, sense of humor, ability to tolerate low stimulation and boredom. This was not a consideration back in the early days of space when we were sort of really tuned into the space program. So now you're as likely to be a nerd as a hero. You know, I mean, not that nerds can't be heroes. I'm a nerd, certainly. But I just was floored by the way it's changed 180 degrees.
We're speaking with Mary Roach. We're talking about her fascinating book called Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. All right, so now we dig into some of the really most intriguing and interesting stuff in your book. And we should say, too, that this is all carefully gathered information. You're not making, I don't think, any of this up. And honestly, it's really interesting to think about some of these questions that we otherwise just don't give a thought to. For instance, the matter that you talk about in Chapter 14 called Separation Anxiety, subtitled The Continuing Saga of Zero Gravity Elimination. And how does that happen in space? One of the most important things we need to know right off the bat is the fact that excretion in zero gravity is a really tricky problem because we have none of the early warning sensations in that environment. Tell us why not.
Yeah, for the bladder, the human bladder, the way that organ tells you, okay, time to excuse yourself and go to the bathroom, is there's these stretch receptors, and as the bladder starts to fill, you know, with gravity, it's all down in the bottom of the organ, and it starts to, you know, stretch out the sides of the organ. Well, in zero gravity, and then the stretch receptors trigger the, you know, impulse in your brain to go to the bathroom. Now, zero gravity, the liquid is actually clinging by surface tension to all of the organs, sort of in a sphere. You have sort of a bubble of liquid, so it's a lot longer before it starts expanding, you know, stretching out the bladder and telling you you have to go. And it can be so extreme that your bladder, by the time you realize you have to go, your urethra is pressed shut from the pressure. And then you've got a little bit of a medical emergency. You've got to get out the self-catheterization kit, and it's embarrassing. So the astronauts are essentially potty trained. They're told by, there's a guy down at Johnson Space Center who trains them all, and he explains this, and he says, so, okay, you're going to go to, you're going to, you know, set your clock, you're going to go to the toilet, whether or not you think you need to, you're going to go every few hours because you don't want to get into trouble because your body's not going to let you know. And I found that fascinating. You know, I mean, I've heard, you know, you did a lot of tee-hee stuff about going to the bathroom in space, but the physiology was fascinating. He said same thing's going on with number two. You've got not the same sort of signals to the brain, and so it's amazing what astronauts, they kind of take these high-achieving, top-of-their-class individuals and put them back in preschool in a way.
Well, right, absolutely, and I'm sure Gus Grissom and Alan Shepard and John Glenn never thought that they would have to learn about fecal popcorning. It's just amazing the kind of things that end up being important. In chapter 10 of your book, Houston, We Have a Fungus, you take on another matter, which is that of hygiene in space. And how do we or can we keep astronauts clean through the course of a long flight? Explain why this is even more of a challenge than we might first imagine.
Well, first off, you don't have a shower, because showers, if you have a nozzle with water coming out, it goes for a little way, and then it starts to form this blob of water. And the blobs, making matters worse, they tend to stick to the concave parts of your body, like your eyes, your nostrils, your mouth. You can really run a risk of kind of choking and drowning in the shower. So, there's a great description. One of the cosmonauts on Salyut had a description of, you know, what a strange sight it is to see a naked man flying across the room with a snorkel mask going to the shower. But very quickly they just abandoned the whole business of showers, because they were constantly chasing down droplets of water, and the cleanup afterward was far more lengthy than the actual shower itself. And so they just switched to, you just wipe yourself. You've got little moist towelettes that you wipe yourself. But really, space is, it's kind of a backpacking, camping mentality. You're never going to be able to have a real nice, hot, relaxing bath or shower. I came across these amazing studies done just before Gemini, where they had a space cabin simulator, and they were having these poor college students. They were putting them in spacesuits for weeks at a time, not letting them bathe, and then documenting the squalor, really, just like checking, you know, how far is the bacteria migrating, and how bad do their armpits smell, and can a human being stand this? And so they, Gemini was really, Gemini 7 was this restricted hygiene space mission where Frank Borman and Jim Lovell were up there, and they'd have these consults with the flight surgeon going, Frank, are you having any dandruff up there? Just like two guys orbiting the Earth talking about skincare.
We should finally just touch on the matter of food. And one of the things that's so interesting about this chapter, again, is how what we might imagine to be, you know, relatively straightforward questions and challenges just are not in space. And it's really an interesting history. And some of the scariest stuff is what happened in the beginning in terms of what they thought astronauts could and would want to consume in space.
Oh, yeah. In the beginning, they had all these, the food, because it's a little capsule, they had to be a lot of weight restrictions. They wanted, and space restrictions. They wanted something small. They wanted it bite-sized so there'd be no crumbs. You just pop it in your mouth. And they, for an extra measure of safety, they coated it in this sort of waxy, oily coating. The other consideration was they wanted it to be, quote-unquote, low residue, meaning very highly processed, so there's not much to be excreted, because really the solution, with a space capsule there, there's no toilet. You were going to the bathroom in a little bag. So the astronauts would try to make it the entire duration of the mission without using the dreaded fecal bag. So the food was actually designed to not generate a lot of residue. So it was very processed. They were very unappealing. Some of the astronauts just didn't eat. You know, there was a lot of weight loss going on because these little foods, like, you know, dehydrated bite-sized beef sandwich. Well, they're adorable to look at, but they were just hideous to eat. You'd have to rehydrate them in your mouth with your own saliva. They were ghastly things, and they tended to fly into space and then fly back down again because nobody ate their full rations.
I don't remember if it was that or something else that you described as a digestive fiasco. But, you know, we can kind of chuckle about it now, but you really can't afford to have much in the way of fiascos in space. And I wonder, as we conclude here, if you found that, in fact, it was kind of a strange split-brain experience to be writing lightheartedly about things which really are kind of funny and entertaining, and yet which are, in many cases, much more serious matters, especially for those men and women in space, than we might ever imagine.
Yeah, astronauts have a surprisingly robust sense of humor about this stuff. I interviewed Jim Lovell. He had been in, you know, he's the one who was in that restricted hygiene Gemini 7, where they were going to make them wear their spacesuits the entire 2 weeks. They took them off. They couldn't stand it. But he had an amazing. They just take these things in stride. Because I said, so you're sitting there basically on a love seat with another guy, and you've got to use this bag. And isn't that like this breakdown of human dignity? And you know, he's like, you get used to it. He said, after a while, you don't even turn away. You know, it's sort of this comic intimacy that develops, and it's sort of a testament to how the human spirit can adapt to just about anything.
There's a moment when one of the early astronauts is quoted as saying something like, you know, what a sight. You know, what an incredible sight this is. And I think that might have been Jim Lovell. And of course, you suggest that it might be all kinds of things and not at all the celestial grandeur which we might imagine that one sees when you're cooped up tight in such close quarters. Well, all kinds of things for us to think about, thanks to your wonderful book, Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void, published by W.W. Norton & Company. Mary Roach, you've done it again. Thank you for joining me on The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm excited to share with you an interview that I recorded with a young man from Kenosha originally who has just graduated from Gateway Technical College's nursing program. His name is Sam Sackett, and he speaks with great eloquence and sincerity about why he has decided to go into nursing and what excites him about it and what it was like to have his studies here at Gateway in a sense, radically changed in the last couple of months as teaching and learning had to migrate to online platforms. So that's tomorrow on The Morning Show. On Thursday, my interview with the author of an intriguing book called Religion Around Bono. And of course, many of you know the name of Bono as the lead singer of the group U2, one of the most popular and influential groups in the world. Bono is a fascinating figure, and his relationship with religion is really fascinating as well. We're going to explore that on Thursday. On Friday, we'll be speaking with several area clergy about the vexing question of whether or not to return to in-person worship services. And we'll find out how several different churches in southeastern Wisconsin are thinking about this and planning for this. Over the weekend, a couple of fascinating interviews as part of the Morning Show podcast, including one with sports writer Tom Kircher and his book Cracked Sidewalks and French Pastry, The Wit and Wisdom of Al McGuire. I'm not sure in all my years doing the Morning Show I've ever received more positive feedback than for that conversation. That interview from way back in 2002 will be shared on the Saturday Morning Show podcast. You can subscribe to the Morning Show podcast via Spotify, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast. Make sure you look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. And of course, as always, The Morning Show is also archived on WGTD's